Thanks for coming. My name is Caitlin Casasa. I'm going to be kicking us off this morning, and then Danny is going to kind of come up here after the break. All right, so I'm an LISW, which you guys probably don't know what that means. That's okay. That just means licensed independent social worker, meaning I have a master's in social work. I work at an organization called Amethyst, which is a treatment center for women, specifically women who come in even with their children. And we provide substance abuse counseling, trauma work, mental health. But this issue is also something that's important to me personally. I've had loved ones struggling with addiction. I've lost a family member due to an overdose. And so this is something I care about not just professionally, but on a personal level. And I think it's really important that we are equipped as a fellowship to know how we can minister to people struggling with this. This is a huge problem. So kind of with that, you know, why should we discuss this today? I think, you know, you guys are here, obviously, you care about this, you know, you believe that this is an issue. You know, we've all heard about the opiate epidemic in the U.S., even in Ohio. This is just a graph showing deaths by drug overdoses. And you can see that in 2017, we hit over 70,000, which is, you know, a huge number. This surpassed the number of people dying by car accidents several years back. Some people say it's, you know, surpassed, I think it was a few years ago, the number of people who died in the war in Vietnam. So tons of people are being impacted by this. And we know that Ohio is actually a really big epicenter of this problem. We can see that Ohio, in the list of states with drug overdose deaths, we're second. And that's pretty crazy when you think about the fact that some of these other states have a way higher population than we do. So clearly, even here in Columbus and Ohio, tons of people are being affected by this. And our fellowship, our home churches, we have the opportunity to get involved in a really cool way. So if you want to learn more, here's just some book recommendations. We don't have time this morning to go into, like, why is Ohio specifically so affected by this? You know, how did this problem kind of increase? And if you have more questions about resources, definitely talk to us after. But what I want to do this morning is give a little bit of background, some more theoretical framework of how can we understand addiction. And then Danny's going to come up and he's going to get more practical. What can we do to help? So how do we define addiction? I think the most simple definition is addiction is any repeated behavior, substance related or not, in which a person feels compelled to persist regardless of the negative impact on their own life or the lives of other people. So I think it's important to note in the definition that this doesn't have to be substance related. That's kind of what we're focusing on this morning. But most of what we're going to say really applies to any sort of addiction, any sort of addictive behavior. Gambling, pornography, the list goes on. And I like this explanation by this author, Gabor Mate. We're going to be quoting from him a lot this morning. He wrote the book In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, which is a really helpful introduction. He says, any passion can become an addiction, but then how to distinguish between the two? The central question is, who's in charge, the individual or their behavior? The addiction is the repeated behavior in which a person keeps engaging, even though he knows it harms himself or others. How it looks externally is irrelevant. The key issue is a person's internal relationship to the passion and its related behaviors. And I like this point that he brings up. It's not just about what it looks like on the outside. You know, a lot of people struggling with drug addiction, it's very obvious. There are a lot of external symptoms or things that are noticeable. But a lot of these other addictive behaviors are easier to hide. Other people might not know what's going on, but it's that internal relationship. Or is the person really kind of under compulsion or feeling like they're being controlled by this behavior? And it reminds me of what Paul brings up in 1 Corinthians 6. You know, he's responding to the Corinthians' attitude that, well, I have the right to do anything. He says, well, but not everything's beneficial. Or I have the right to do anything, but I will not be mastered by anything. So there's this biblical call for the believer to not be mastered by anything, by any behavior, by any substance. And I think that's kind of what Mate is talking about here. So how do we distinguish someone, you know, just using substances from addiction? we're all going to get people who come to our home church who frequently go out and get wasted or maybe smoke a decent amount of weed. And it's not that they have addiction. It's just that's kind of normal for their lifestyle in the world. And just some, you know, biblical teaching, maybe once they become a believer on why that's damaging, they'd be able to stop. So how do we distinguish that from someone maybe with addiction or with a more serious problem? I think that we should be careful not to think about this in a super black and white way. There's not just one single cutoff point, one binary yes or no. Okay, yes, either it's totally healthy, it's totally fine, or this person is addicted. It's more of a spectrum all the way from, you know, healthy, normal behavior to extremely damaging. Because we don't want to have to set us one certain cutoff point where the, you know, the scale tips, because there's a lot of factors to take into consideration. And a little bit of information on, you know, how this gets diagnosed in a clinical setting. A lot of us use the words like substance abuse or substance dependence. They actually took those words out of the most recent edition of the DSM. The DSM is just like it's called the Diagnostic Statistical Manual. It's what psychiatrists and psychologists and counselors use to diagnose disorders. And in 2013, the most recent edition, they took out those terms and they're just calling it substance use disorder. And then there's just a range of severity. So you could either have mild, moderate, or severe based on your symptoms. And so they're kind of thinking more in this continuum way. However, I think the words abuse and dependence can still be helpful to distinguish. You know, abuse maybe implies that that person is willfully trying to use the substance in a damaging way to get some experience out of it. Dependence maybe speaks more to that felt loss of control. But that's kind of the clinical definition right now. And so I want to go through a few areas that we should really look for when we're trying to distinguish, okay, does this person have an addiction? Do they have a serious problem? And the first one is impaired control. So this is the person that is using longer than they intended to, or using larger amounts than they intended to. You know, I went out last night and I was only going to have 2 beers, and I ended up having 9, and I didn't get home until a lot later than I expected. This person maybe wants to reduce their use. They're making promises that they're going to stop, they're going to cut back, and yet they're just unsuccessful in doing so. They don't follow through. The person who is just spending more and more amounts of time either trying to get a hold of or using or recovering from using their substance. And this person has cravings that are so intense, it's beginning to kind of take over their thought life, take over their day. It's difficult to think about anything else. We also have social impairment. So this is things like someone is starting to have problems at work or at school because of their using. Maybe they're oversleeping, they're missing class, they're showing up late to work, they're getting fired because of what's going on. Maybe they're starting to have issues in their relationships, tension with family members, you know, distance with friends, and yet they're continuing to use, even though maybe people are bringing this up to them that it's a problem. And they're probably also maybe giving up things that used to be important to them. You know, the things that they enjoy, the hobbies, all of that is kind of diminishing as more and more focus is put on the using. We also have risky use. So the person is putting themselves in dangerous situations just to be able to get a hold of their substance or to be able to use. And they're continuing to use even though they know that it's damaging for them. Maybe they're experiencing physical symptoms from using, or psychologically they can see that it's damaging, and yet they're continuing to persist. And finally, we have pharmacological indicators, which this is maybe what a lot of us think of with addiction, this idea of tolerance and withdrawal. So tolerance is the person needs even more of that substance to get the same effect that they were getting before from a lesser amount. And withdrawal is what happens when they stop using the substance. Their body has a certain response to that because it's accustomed to having the substance. And that looks different for different drugs, for different substances. But overall, it's a phenomenon that can happen with any of them. So what causes addiction? You know, we can try to recognize and see that someone has a problem, but something that's confusing for a lot of people is like, well, what would lead one person to become addicted and not somebody else? Maybe they're both using the same substance. And really, this is a huge source of debate. There's not necessarily a very clean-cut answer. There's a lot of different camps, a lot of different opinions, and we're going to kind of look through some of the most popular perspectives. So you've got what I would call the personal responsibility models. This is kind of, maybe you've heard the term moral model. The emphasis is just on the individual. You know, they just lack self-control. It's just weakness, and they just need to stop. They just need to cut it out. And there is an aspect of truth to this. You know, the Bible agrees that there's a choice involved, that this is wrong. Paul in Ephesians 5 says, do not get drunk on wine, which leads to debauchery. Instead, be filled with the Spirit. So he's implying here that there's a choice, that he is calling on believers to not live a life of intoxication. However, the problem with this model is often it can be really oversimplified and then not very helpful. Just by kind of finger wagging at the person, you know, you need to stop, you need to cut it out, this is messed up, probably isn't going to lead to a lot of change. We've got the agent models, where this is kind of the emphasis is put on the drug or the substance itself, the agent. It's just that the drug is so powerful that anybody would get addicted to it. And this was kind of the thinking behind the temperance movement, prohibition. You can see these ladies felt this way. Lips that touch liquor shall not touch ours. So they feel strongly about this. But just this focus on the fact that it's the substance itself that's just so, it's so evil, it's so powerful, and we just need to get rid of the substances because, you know, if anyone comes into contact with them, they're going to get addicted. But in reality, we know that's actually not true. This is a study from 1994, so it's a little outdated, but I think a lot of it would hold true today. It says that 32% of people who tried nicotine even once went on to long-term habitual use. For alcohol, marijuana, and cocaine, it was about 15%, and 23% for heroin. So if the agent model is totally true, then these numbers would be 100%, but they're not. So clearly, there's other factors at play beyond just the fact that the substances themselves have addictive properties, because not everyone who comes into contact with them becomes addicted. And I want to make a little caveat here that I think we should keep this in mind when we're talking about the opiate epidemic. It's really easy, obviously, to get upset and to feel angry at really the role of the pharmaceutical companies in what's happened and the really, the marketing that was super dishonest, all of the over-prescribing of prescription, you know, painkillers. And I agree that is messed up and has led to a lot of issues. But I think we're oversimplifying the problem if our focus is just on the fact that, well, all these people have access to prescription painkillers, because not everybody who has taken a painkiller becomes addicted. And so, yes, it's a problem. Yes, we should be really mindful about the amount that people are being prescribed, but we might be missing other factors that lead someone to be predisposed to be addicted if we're only focusing on the substance itself. So we also have the medical models, or maybe you've heard the term disease model. This one is really the most popular right now when it comes to like a professional or clinical setting. This is really what is emphasized and what's taught. That, you know, addiction is just a disease like any other, and there's changes in the brain, it leads to a loss of control. And I think there are helpful aspects of this model, but again, we get into trouble if we pigeonhole ourselves and just camp out here, because there's certain things that we're going to miss. There's certain damage, I think, that over-focusing on this can do. Because this implies that someone really then doesn't have the power to change, and that they're just completely a victim with no sense of responsibility. And as we're going to talk about later with Danny's material, I think we can see why that would actually be counterproductive. Finally, there's some social learning models where the emphasis is really on, you know, maybe think about what you learned in psychology class, operant and classical conditioning, and that this is just a learned behavior based on the family environment, you know, people associating certain results from using. It's a socially learned behavior. The bottom line is there's not a single answer. I hope that's clear from, you know, what we just talked about, that this is really complicated, and we shouldn't feel the need to ascribe super strongly to just one of these models. It's really a holistic approach that's needed that takes all the factors, the whole person, into consideration. And I like what Matte has to say here. He says that we need to view this simultaneously from many different angles, or at least while examining it from one angle, we need to keep the others in mind. Addiction has biological, chemical, neurological, psychological, medical, emotional, social, political, economic, and spiritual underpinnings, and perhaps others I haven't thought about. So it's complicated. And for the sake of time today, I just want to spend a little bit of time talking about two areas that I think are often involved here in predisposing someone to become addicted, and that's development and trauma. So the role of childhood development. Matte claims in his book that brain development in the uterus and during childhood is the single most important biological factor in determining whether or not a person will be predisposed to addiction. So pretty strong statement there. But I think there's actually reason, you know, for us to consider this. We know that for humans, 75% of brain growth takes place outside of the womb. Unlike all other mammals, you know, we're born pretty helpless with still a lot of work to do. We're not able to just, you know, be born and then go off and be independent. There's a really long period of nurturing and development still needed. But we know that those first few years are particularly formative. By age 3, even though our body is only 18% of its adult size, our brain is 90% of its adult size. So there's a lot happening there, especially in those first few years. We also know that the expression of our genetic potential is mostly based on the environment. You know, a lot of people want to emphasize genes, and is there a genetic cause behind addiction? Is there like some sort of, you know, gene that people could have that means they're going to become addicted? But we know that with genes and with our DNA, a lot of it has to do with what happens again after we're born, that, you know, our environment shapes how that's going to play out. And the way I like to think about that is with a plant. You know, a plant has certain genes that it's going to, you know, grow this kind of flower, it's going to, you know, be this species, but how much sunlight, how much water, how much nutrients that plant gets is going to have a huge impact on how it actually grows, if it's going to be susceptible to disease, if it's going to be healthy. And we can think about humans in the same way. So we know that emotional nurturance is really necessary for our brains to develop the way they're supposed to. Specifically, children need an attachment relationship with at least one adult, but preferably more, preferably both parents, where that parent is reliable, they're available, they're psychologically available, you know, emotionally present, they're protective, and reasonably non-stressed. And the void here often isn't in the parent's intention. It's not that the parent doesn't love their child or isn't committed to their child. There might be a lot of other factors going on that would hinder the parent's ability to be that attuned adult that the child needs. But it's about the child's perception. Is that adult engaged? And we know that what happens when this is lacking is chronic stress. Researchers have studied stress, and they found that universally across the board, the things that cause stress for humans are uncertainty, lack of information, loss of control, overwhelming conflict, and isolation from emotionally supportive relationships. So you can begin to think about how some of those factors could be present in a lot of homes. It may be a situation where there's a divorce early on, or there's, you know, other factors just causing a lot of stress on the parents, maybe financial worries going on. So we're not just talking here about situations of black and white abuse or something, but just any sort of stress on the child is going to have an impact on their development. And we know that what happens with chronic stress in a child is that it's actually going to lower the set point for their internal stress system, which basically just is a fancy way of saying they're going to get stressed more easily later in life. They're going to be more vulnerable then to the pleasurable experience of a substance. We can think about that, you know, with the example of water. All of us like water. Some of us are probably drinking water right now. But it's not something we're thinking a lot about. It's, you know, it's just something we do to survive. But imagine the person who's been wandering in the desert. They're dehydrated, their throat's parched, you know, they're so thirsty, and they get a drink of water. It's not that the water is any different, but the relief that they feel because of that thirst that they had, it's going to make that experience way more powerful. They're going to like it a lot more than us just sitting here on a Saturday morning drinking water. And that's how we can think about someone without chronic stress versus someone who grew up maybe experiencing chronic stress and how they're going to feel about that experience of trying a substance and the relief that it offers. We know that when a child's under chronic stress, it raises the levels of cortisol in their body, which is our stress hormone, and that has a lot of effects on our body, including shrinking our hippocampus, which is a region in the brain responsible for memory, among other things. We know that chronic stress actually diminishes the child's opioid and dopamine receptors in their brain, so their own brain system of opioids and dopamine are going to be that development is going to be threatened, meaning they're going to be way more susceptible to look to external sources of opioids, of dopamines, those feel-good, you know, reward, motivation hormones, because they're not getting those in their own brain. And finally, stress really inhibits a child's ability to just emotionally mature, to learn how to self-regulate and self-soothe, because children learn that through being soothed and regulated by that caregiver. Further, we know that parental nurturing really affects your brain's levels of, you know, all of these different neurochemicals, endorphins, dopamine, serotonin, benzodiazepines, norepinephrine, oxytocin, you know, on and on. There's a lot that happens in our brain, either with the presence or absence of this attachment. One example is that we know when a child has one of these attuned interactions with a caregiver, our brain releases endorphins, and endorphins are really the body's natural opioid. The word endorphin actually comes from the word morphine. And that is helping, again, promote that child's development of their own opioid and dopamine circuitry. And so you can imagine if that's lacking, then that child is being set up to really want to seek that elsewhere from an external source. So the bottom line here is that the reason that drugs are able to work is not super mystical. They resemble the brain's natural chemicals, chemicals and systems that we all have and that should develop properly. But if maybe there's especially a problem in development, we're going to be more likely to seek that out externally. So I want to talk a little bit here about trauma. We know that addiction is almost always rooted in some sort of pain. It's an attempt to cope. I don't know if you guys are familiar with the ACEs study. This was a set of research that was done that now they've developed this questionnaire. It's 10 questions, and an ACE is an adverse child experience. So for every question that you answer yes to, that's 1 point. You can have up to 10. So this includes things like if you had physical abuse growing up, sexual abuse, neglect, maybe a parent was incarcerated, maybe a parent was using substances in the home. And they found that for every adverse child experience that someone has, their risk for early using of substances goes up 2 to 4 times. And that for someone who has 5 or more of these adverse child experiences, they have a 7 to 10 greater times risk for substance use. So this research is telling us clearly there's a correlation here. Mate has to say this about trauma. He says, it's not what happened in the past that creates our present misery, but the way we have allowed the past events to define how we see and experience ourselves in the present. The greatest damage done by neglect, trauma, or emotional loss is not the immediate pain they inflict, but the long-term distortions they induce in the way a developing child will continue to interpret the world and her situation in it. And I've definitely seen this to be true, you know, working with my clients and the trauma that they've experienced. It's not just the thing that they went through in the past and, you know, physically what happened. It's these negative core beliefs that they developed, that they internalized about themselves based on what happened. These long-term distortions that he's talking about. When you think about someone who's been through sexual abuse, often you'll hear things like, it was my fault. I should have done something. I'm dirty. I'm broken. No one's going to want me. That is the kind of stuff that we're talking about, this deep-rooted pain that, of course, then we can begin to see why addiction is really just a way to cope. I mean, the drug is really offering this person an emotional anesthetic, an antidote to this emptiness that maybe they're feeling, this a tonic against fatigue and boredom and alienation, the sense of personal inadequacy, a stress reliever, a social lubricant. Maybe it's hard for them to even know how to connect with other people because of what they've been through. And this, you know, helps with that. But what about someone who doesn't seem to have a traumatic history? I think this is a natural question. You know, we're talking about kind of these more extreme cases, people who've been through really severe trauma. Okay, it makes sense that they'd become addicted, but what about the person I know in my life who it seems like they had a good childhood? Like they didn't go through anything crazy. We're not just talking here about these huge, really extreme situations. Those are more obvious. But there's a lot of other things that we can go through that maybe it's about how we interpreted it, how we internalized it, that it might have affected us way more than people around even knew. And I want to read a quote from this author, Bruce Alexander, because I think what he says in this quote kind of just helps maybe stir our imagination a little bit on what other things internally could be at play in someone who ends up addicted. So he says, many junkies come from prosperous, apparently harmonious families. Why would they become junkies? Dislocation sometimes grows from devastating inabilities to meet highly internalized standards of achievement, rendering them unacceptable failures in their own estimation. In addition, some prosperous but frigid families maintain an impenetrable veneer of warmth that camouflages subtle cruelty or dysfunction. Alternatively, dislocation in junkies-to-be may come from painful rejection by their peers. Embracing the most feared and despised of all drugs, he's talking about heroin here, is a bold counterattack upon the emptiness and boredom that often fills an affluent life. To be a junkie is to kick sand in the face of respectability with its myriad hypocrisies. It is to work a terrible revenge on resented parents. To be a junkie is to be feared as well as pitied, to provoke awe as well as to endure humiliation. It is a starkly honest position. It is preferable to be infamous than to be utterly inconsequential or a contradictory bundle of identity fragments, as Erickson put it. The psychosocial benefits of being a junkie, including a compelling sense of purpose, a well-recognized identity, the release of boredom, and the power to shock and horrify straight people, have been extensively documented by therapists, social scientists, and junkie authors. So I think some of the points he brings up there are helpful for us to consider. You know, he mentions that maybe these problems, this rejection came from peers, maybe not from the family at all. Maybe it was this person's own standard that they thought was being placed on them that they felt like they weren't living up to. So it's not just these, you know, cases of really dramatic abuse we're talking about. There could be a lot internally that affected someone and maybe pain that they're feeling now. At the root, we know that addiction is really a spiritual issue. And what's funny is that as you read the literature on this topic, researchers and clinicians and doctors and you know all these professionals writing on this, they can't help themselves, but they end up talking about this. Even if their stated position in their book is that they're an atheist, you know, they don't believe in God, they don't believe in the supernatural, they all bring up spirituality. And it's a very well-documented, very credible, you know, in the field source of healing, that people actually encourage clients to be involved with spiritual things, even though those people themselves might not believe in it, which is really interesting. Mate, he says this in his book, one consequence of spiritual deprivation is addiction, and not only to drugs. At conferences devoted to science-based addiction medicine, it is more and more common to hear presentations on the spiritual aspect of addictions and their treatment. At the core of all addictions, there lies a spiritual void. We have something in or about us that transcends the firing and wiring of neurons and the actions of chemicals. The mind may reside mostly in the brain, but it is much more than the sum total of the autonomic neurological programs rooted in our past. And there is something else in us and about us. It is called by many names, spirit being the most democratic and least denominational or divisive in a religious sense. So he can't help it. You know, he's talking here about the fact that, yeah, we can't get too reductionistic. It's not just about this neuroscience. There's clearly something deeper. You know, humans have a soul or a spirit or whatever you want to call it. And he says that at the heart of all addiction, there's a spiritual void. Coming from someone who doesn't believe in God or anything spiritual, really interesting. Biblically speaking,
we would say that really at the heart of addiction is idolatry. Paul in Ephesians 4 says, in reference to your former manner of life, that you should lay aside the old self, which is being corrupted in accordance with the lusts of deceit. So this lust of deceit, looking elsewhere for things that we really should get from God. And we know that lust is this warped desire, a desire for something in the wrong place, an over-desire. And we see that this plays a huge role in addiction. Matthew says again that addictions, even though they resemble normal human yearnings, are more about desire than attainment. In the addicted mode, the emotional charge is in the pursuit and the acquisition of the desired object, not in the possession and enjoyment of it. The greatest pleasure is in the momentary satisfaction of yearning. The fundamental addiction is to the fleeting experience of not being addicted. The addict craves the absence of the craving state. For a brief moment, he's liberated from emptiness, from boredom, from lack of meaning, from yearning, from being driven, or from pain. He is free. His enslavement to the external, the substance, the object, or the activity, consists of the impossibility in his mind of finding within himself the freedom from longing or irritability. So addiction is characterized by this lust of deceit, this longing, this yearning for freedom. But Paul says that it's of deceit because these things that we go to, substances or anything else, they might promise happiness or relief or comfort, but they destroy rather than satisfy. I found this piece of information in a really like technical kind of scientific book on addiction, but I thought it actually fit really well with what we're talking about here. This author says that recovery, it doesn't mean a cure for a disease, but the creation of new resources, internal and external, that can support different healthy ways of satisfying one's genuine needs. That's really what we're talking about, is we have legitimate needs as humans that God wants to fill, and yet the problem is that we're looking elsewhere to these substances or to other behaviors to try to fill those instead. And so it's not about someone with addiction being like magically cured of a disease. It's redirecting where can they actually get those needs met. And Danny's going to talk a lot more about that. But to kind of end this section, I was thinking about what it says in Jonah 2:8, that those who cling to worthless idols turn away from God's love for them. And this could really sum up, all of human history could sum up the problem of addiction, but probably a lot in our own lives as well. And so briefly, before we take a break, I just want to highlight a little bit about what Xenos is already doing here. You know, you may or may not be familiar with this, but we actually have three different ministries that are dedicated to helping people either struggling with substance use or loved ones of people struggling with substance use. And we're going to have more information at the end, like brochures and printed material, if you want information on this or if you want to know how to get in contact with the people leading these ministries. But we have Hope and Never Alone, which are for people struggling with substance use. Hope is a Bible study. Never Alone is also a Bible study and expressly Christ-centered, but more kind of following that traditional 12-step model. If you're familiar with like AA or NA, it's that kind of model, but explicitly, you know, the God of the Bible, Christ-centered. And Promise is for, you know, people who have loved ones struggling with addiction. So the people running these ministries are doing really awesome work. They've been doing it for a while. And definitely would be a great resource if you need more help with someone that you're trying to help or you've got questions or you want to get involved, definitely talk to the people leading those. But now we're going to take just like a 5-minute break while Danny gets set up here, and then we're going to get more practical into how can we help.
We're going to go ahead and get started. The second half of things. So we're going to move into the more practical helping portion of working with addiction in ministry. I've tried to put as much practical stuff into this as I could. And I'm not sure if we're going to have time to go over all of it, but hopefully there's enough detail even on the slides that could be utilized if we don't cover it. So my name is Danny. Like Caitlin said, I'm a clinical mental health counselor at Wellspring Counseling. My wife and I also help lead a group of the college ministry. So my work with addiction, I think, comes from two places, kind of like Caitlin's. There's a personal and a clinical dimension to it. I, um, I came from a home that was broken apart by substance use. My mom, I think still to this day, is an alcoholic, and I think she's homeless somewhere. I grew up going to AA, NA meetings with my dad, who actually is a substance abuse doctor as well. My older sister was a heroin addict for several years and supported that habit, working on the streets. I was in and out of treatment centers throughout my adolescence, homeless by the end of high school. And so I've had a lot of personal experience with that. I got clean when I was about 20 years old, and then I went to go start college. And it's like, well, you know, the advisor asked, well, what are you interested in? What do you like? It's like, I know I like getting high, you know, I know drugs. So it's like, I'll do substance abuse counseling. And so that's what my undergraduate degree was in, substance abuse counseling. Went on to get my master's in clinical mental health counseling. So I could have more of a holistic picture of addiction. And so it's something that I like to think that I have a balanced approach on. And I've also been able to work with addiction in ministry over the last several years and have a home church that's has a lot of addicts in it. We've got recovering heroin addicts, crackheads, garbage heads, you know, where you put it all in a blender. Just every type of person from that background. And so I'd like to think I have a personal, clinical, and try to take a real theological dimension to it and have a balanced view. So there's not one just kind of extreme. And I think there's this thing out there, this thought that, well, if I don't have experience with it, I can't work with it. And there's actually no research to suggest that. No research to suggest you can't be helpful if you haven't struggled with addiction. And I think we can be. And Caitlin read this quote by Dr. Mate in that book, and where he points out, right, that there's some part of us that transcends our biology and our development, right? From a reductionist thinker to say there's something about us that transcends this, it's fascinating. But we know biblically that's the case. And see, that's the part of the person that we aim to impact as helpers, right? Because what is that part? That's the personhood. That is the heart of the individual. That's the soul, right? And so that's the part we come alongside and we can have an impact on. Now, what is it that we are aiming on in the most simple, basic terms, in the most practical, simple terms? What is it that we're going to try to help the addicted person do? Well, ultimately, it's going to be to resist and replace, right? In the most simple, practical terms, to resist, right, the use itself, the temptations to use, the behaviors, the destructive behaviors that come from that use, and to replace that with what? A fulfillment that's in line, that comes from a life in line with the way God has designed us, right? That's really what we're aiming at here. And I think the replaced portion is the portion that is so important, and I think that is where we come in the most, the replaced portion, right? Because we don't want to have this kind of fix what's broken mentality. It's really easy to have that, especially when you see somebody's a mess, right? That they're a person in pieces that need put back together, but that's not the way Scripture talks about it, right? In Scripture, there's this kind of building something new picture for the individual who's broken, right? You see that in the language, that it's the changed language of the New Testament is going from the old self to the new self, right? It's moving from darkness to light, from death to life, right? This is a person with these God-given capacities that have not been utilized yet. And we're able to look and notice those and see those from God's perspective and come alongside that person. So I think that's especially important. You can see this change language, 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 22, right, where he says, "Flee the evil desires of youth and pursue righteousness, faith, love, and peace, along with those who call on the Lord out of a pure heart." So where's the emphasis here in change, right? Well, he uses a lot more words to describe what the person is moving towards, right? That's what God is interested in, is what he wants to make us into, not just what he wants to get rid of. But, you know, you can read the addiction literature, and I've read a lot more than I, you know, care to have read, but you read it and you can start to think like, well, is it really that simple? Like, is it, you know, Caitlin kind of went through some of these things, but is it really that simple? Is Scripture really useful in like speaking to substance dependence? Is it really going to be that helpful? I mean, can we really just lump it into the category of evil desire, right? Can we really just call this a problem of desire? And I think we need to step back and consider that question carefully, right? Because it's not black and white, right? Does the research have something to offer us? Yeah, it shares that there is a real complexity to this problem. And one you'll see on the surface, too. You don't need the research to suggest that, right? But you know, if you get to look inside a car, right, as it's driving somewhere, as it's operating, you can see all the mechanisms moving, right? You might even see why it goes a particular direction as you notice the wheel turn and affect how all of these things work. I don't know cars. I wouldn't understand it, but, right, you would recognize these things. What you wouldn't know is why it's choosing to go a particular direction with the little amount of gas that it has in the condition it's in, right? You wouldn't know why unless you talk to the driver. In the same way, we see something like a relationship between desire and dopamine, right? That's very real, that when this chemical is taken in, dopamine goes up in the brain, and this expression of desire is increased. So we have a relationship between those different things, and that's significant, right? And that's important, right? But that doesn't explain the whole problem, right? That gives us kind of a glimpse into it. It explains, you know, why something like a drug like cocaine, for instance, can reach a point in its use where somebody is compelled by desire to use, even though the substance has lost all its pleasurable effects and now only causes pain. Why would somebody still be addicted to that, right? Well, we can see, well, this is what's happening in the brain. But again, like the car talking to the driver to really understand why it's going where it's going, when you talk to the individual, right, they're expressing a pursuit of something, right, that they're very cognizant of. They'll talk often about, right, how it started as a desire for pleasure, right, how that grew. And eventually it was a desire to meet these deeper needs. Caitlin talked about these spiritual things, and you'll hear people use spiritual terms when they tell you why they're using, right, for some kind of comfort, right, contentment, for peace, for happiness, for alleviation of some kind of indescribable sensation that they have. So they're trying to meet deep needs with this at some point, and they become aware of that. So we're appealing to the heart as helpers. We're appealing to this desire. We want to help reorient that thing to a desire that's right. I was thinking about this, like, you know, Caitlin used the water in the desert illustration, right? And you could tweak that a little bit. Like, if you were thirsty and you saw a glass of water on the table and had a drop of poison in it, right? You might be thirsty. That might be attractive, but for some of us, we would know that. But we wouldn't go drink that because, like, well, it's going to kill me. I'm not going to do that, right? But if you, again, like Caitlin, you're walking through the desert for a period of time, that same glass of water with the drop of poison in it, all of us might get to a point where desire brings about almost a compulsion that overrides free will. It doesn't, but it feels like we're kind of there, right? Now, we, as helpers, we want to show the person they're not in a desert, and that glass of water is not the only option, right? In fact, there's something a lot more fulfilling that requires, that does not destroy you, right? I'm not sure if you guys are familiar with this. There's this sermon by an old Scottish minister theologian called The Expulsive Power of a New Affection. And in it, he describes this, he talks about this grasping tendency of the human heart. He talks about, right, how it's not enough just to discredit a particular desire, right? It's not enough if somebody wants that desire removed. It's not enough just to explain why that thing is damaging and that it won't satisfy. It's not enough to convince them of that, right? Because the heart has this grasping tendency. It seems to have been designed to lay hold of a thing, to pursue a thing of desire, right? And so it's not enough just to remove that. In fact, he says, if you just get rid of it, the fix was broken mentality, if you succeed, and that's all they're focused on, is not doing the thing that's damaging, he says it's comparable to hunger in the natural systems. Right? It needs to be replaced with something. They have a term for this in AA and NA called the dry drunk, like the person who has actually been convinced to stop doing the thing, but not because of a greater thing. And they just end up miserable. And they make everybody else miserable. And it's like, dude, why don't you just go have a drink? You know? They call him the dry drunk. And said, Chalmers says, a more effective path to removing an undesired affection is to set the mind's eye on a more alluring object. Right, that the best way to remove an unhealthy desire is to displace that desire with a greater desire. And that's something, if you think about it, we do that all the time. So, but in regards to addiction, what is the more alluring object? Right, what is it? What are those resources that we have as a church and individuals who know Christ that we can bring before somebody who's struggling with addiction to you know, present that picture of what God wants to do in their life? Well, I think one thing that's really huge, right, is Christ promises to satisfy a deeper hunger and thirst, right? We can come alongside the person and kind of help expose to them, right, that this thing hasn't actually satisfied you. And you know that if you stop to think about it, right? we can help expose that this thing is a lust of deceit, right? As Caitlin used that verse. And we can bring them to what Christ offers, right? John 4, rivers of living water. Or John 6, the bread of life. That Christ actually, you know that need that you're trying to meet through substances? Jesus actually talks about that. He says he's going to satisfy that completely. You know, we can bring that before people. New identity. You know, if you read research on trauma, I was at a trauma seminar recently, and it's interesting. The guy who's another very reductionistic kind of thinker about the problem, but he kept saying, right, this is an identity problem. Because people who have trauma in their past and they use for that reason, this would fit that. But people with this, you know, they often live in this sense of something's wrong, something's off, I'm not okay, I'm gross. You know, Caitlin described these different things. They live, whether they have these actual memories or whether they just kind of wear them like a film, they have this sense of a bad identity, a negative identity. Again, we can bring them before God and we can show them what Christ actually teaches or what God teaches us, that in Christ you can be a new creation, right, where there is no regard for what the past was, right, and that you are totally new in God's eyes. We can present to them this offer of unconditional affirmation and acceptance. Again, there's a perpetual guilt and shame for the person who's really immersed themselves in their substance use and really fully gone into that, right? There's a question that you ask in assessing, doing a substance abuse assessment to see somebody's got a problem because of the criteria of the DSM, and you'll ask, well, have you ever done anything under the influence of the substance that you regret? Right? And usually people with this problem laugh at that question. It's like stealing from people I care about, right? Exchanging sexual favors for the use of a particular substance. It's like, you know, I live in the guilt and shame. At a certain point, use just becomes escaping the guilt and the shame, right? And we can bring them to this picture, right, that nothing can separate us from the love of Christ. Right? This is what God is offering you. And I think a note here, I notice working with a lot of addiction addicts in ministry, and in my own personal case, it's easy for them, even long-term, to get to this point where they see grace as just forgiveness. It's very subtle, but if you see it, it's just across the board, that grace is always just breaking even. It's like, I know God forgives me for this. And it's like, wait a second, like that's as far as you go with the concept of grace, right? This is like unmerited favor. God is still totally in favor of you before, in the midst of, and after your worst things, right? We want to show them like there is an abundance that you are not tapping into here because you only see that one dimension of grace. So that's important. A sense of purpose, right? A sense of purpose and meaning. You hear this in people's testimonies who have overcome addiction. They look back on their time of use and describe it as an aimless wandering, right? I'm doing what I need to do to get what I need to get to feel how I want to feel. And that just takes me wherever it does, you know? And so I have no direction, purpose, meaning. These things are foreign to me, right? In fact, I'm probably escaping some underlying existential knowledge of needing these things. And we can bring them to something like this. This verse is probably the first thing that ever motivated me to look into spirituality was Ephesians 2:10, right? That God has good works prepared in advance for us in Christ. You are designed for a reason. No matter how gross you think you are put together for a specific reason. You think about Friedrich Nietzsche's quote, right, that he who has a why to live can bear almost any how. If you have a why for something, if you're convinced of a why for something, you are going to pursue that. It speaks to the strength of desire, right? You have a why, you're going to pursue that why no matter what gets in your way. It's the same thing we want to see the person become convinced of. An invitation to community. Caitlin talked about dislocation, right? The person is taken out of harmony with these different things because of stuff in the past or what they're doing or and whatnot. And, right, we can present this invitation, right? That there is this, that God invites us to unity with other people, deep unity, right? Like we've never experienced before where there aren't these external identifiers. So what is our role in the helping process? I want to get a little bit more practical here. Okay, so where do we start in coming alongside somebody who's struggling with addiction? The first thing we have to do is assess the person's awareness of their problem. What level of awareness do they have about their problem? Most of the time, we do this pretty intuitively, right? Most of the time, it's pretty common sense for us to know, like, I can't help somebody fix a problem they don't agree they have, right? We usually know that, right? It's like, you're not going to try to convince somebody to buy a treadmill who's still going to the Golden Corral every night for dinner, right? It's like, first you sit down, it's like, food, health, let's talk about it, you know? And then maybe you reach that point later on. Most of the time, that's pretty intuitive, but with addiction, with substance use, it can just look so ugly, right? It's so destructive that you just skip this step, right? You just jump right into, like, this is a problem, we got to fix this, right? You don't even check the person's awareness of their own problem. There's something called the writing reflex in motivational interviewing, right? And this is like, if you see a person walking down a trail or something towards a cliff, right, you're just gonna scream direct information at them. There's no questions, right? Like, don't go that way, that's wrong. Do you not see what's ahead of you? Like, stop, go this way. That makes sense in that context. With addiction, it's not gonna work. The overwhelming majority of the time, it doesn't really work that way to try to write somebody in that sense. And that's because of, like, well, it's because of a lot of things. One of them being ambivalence. The person who struggles with substance use, they have, if they're in any place inclined to change or recognizing the issues, they have two counsels in their head, right? They have a counsel that's arguing for change and a counsel that's arguing for staying the same. The second that you come in and you say, listen, you're destroying your life. This thing is not good for you. It's not going to be helpful. They just take the place of the other counsel. Well, yeah, but I like it. That's an effective coping mechanism. So to just jump in and try to be instructive, it's not very effective most of the time, even though it makes sense why we would do that. So our question here is, and what we're looking for is, to what degree do they realize their substance use is an issue? To what degree do they realize that? And what we're doing then is we're assessing their readiness for change. And it's like, okay, well, I'm assessing their ready. What does that mean? Like, does that mean I'm just waiting for them to be ready to change and I can't do anything? Like, oh, you're not ready? Okay, well, let's talk in a couple weeks, right? It's like, well, no, we assess their readiness for change so that we can work from where the person is at. There are, we're going to talk about the stages of change where we can go and know, okay, based on where they're at, this is the kind of way I want to approach this to help them move in being convinced to not use anymore. Here's this system. So an effective model for change. This was developed by two psychologists, I think in the late 70s, early 80s. And they set out to look at, okay, are there any things that are consistent in this process of change, whether it's from substance use or these other things? And they looked across all these different therapies, right? Is one therapy more effective than the other, blah, blah, blah. What they found is it's not about a specific approach, right? But what they did find consistent was that there are these noticeable stages of change people go through as they're getting better, right? And they identified six stages: pre-contemplation, contemplation, preparation, action, maintenance, and often relapse. And so we're going to go through these a little bit here. And I'm not going to go into detail at this point, but I'll just kind of read through the stage, what it is. And then you can see there's a helper's role and a helper's goal. Okay? And there's some questions on there, just some examples of things. So pre-contemplation, right? This is where somebody with substance use is going to start most of the time, is they're like, I don't have a problem. You got a problem, right? My substance use is not an issue for me. They just don't see the issue with it. They're still looking at all the benefits. What do we do at that place where somebody has no recognition of any issue? You know, we see it clearly. It's like, well, again, it's not jump in and just start trying to tell them how much of an issue it is. If anybody who's tried that knows it doesn't work, right? Instead, the helper's role here, our role, ask questions to help them consider their use from a different perspective, right? How would you know there was a problem? Has it ever caused you problems? Things like that. The helper's goal at this point is just to raise doubt about current perspective on use. Contemplation, right? Maybe I have a problem, right? Maybe shooting dope in a truck stop bathroom is not the norm for most people, and it's going to cause me some problems, right? I'm starting to see that there's damage to this. When they're at that place, the helper's role here, help them continue to question their use. Just help that process continue. What changed in that? Now you're thinking there's some issues here, right? You draw that out. Empathize with them. Yeah, that I could see why you'd be thinking that. That sounds tough, right? So you think the drugs play a role in that. The goal here, tip the decisional balance in favor of change. Preparation. This is when they're at this place where they're saying, okay, so I've been thinking about things I can now do to work on this problem, right? Contemplation has now grown into me starting to think about the steps I would take to actually stop doing this thing. The role here, reinforce those thoughts about change. What kind of things have you thought of? Why is that appealing, you know? The helper's goal, develop a plan for action. Help them start to put those things into practice. The action stage, I am currently doing these things to get some help. Our role here, the helper's role, support, empathize, and encourage, right? Just come alongside them in that process. Has that been helpful? How, you know? And the goal, help them utilize those resources and tools. Maintenance. This is longer term change, right? I haven't struggled with this in a while. So help them to move beyond addiction as a defining feature in their life. That's the helper's role. Some people would disagree with that. Some people think it's an identity kind of thing that you take on. I would disagree with that, but I think we need to help them move beyond it as a defining identity feature. We need to show them that there's more out there. The helper's goal, ongoing growth. To continue growing, right? Spiritually, not just in recovery, right? In this building something new. And then there's often relapse. I mean, you often see relapse in the change process, right? I screwed up. I used again. Role here, remind them of what they have already learned. Helper's goal, prevent fatalism and maintain this kind of forward momentum. Now, I don't think that it's realistic, right, that we would all sit down and memorize each one of these stages. And like, I'm memorizing the stages, I'm memorizing what to do at each stage. That's not super realistic. And part of this is like, because we want to be helpful as a community, as a church, it's like, so when we bring people into fellowship, how do we make healthy ministry decisions that are helpful with this person, right? That's what I want to think of. And so doing that, I think we can simplify these stages. Right, we can break them into three categories. The important thing from this is that you just know there is a process to change and that we're trying to meet the person where they're at realistically, okay? And I think the first stage and the first kind of perspective stage in making ministry decisions is prior to action. What to do prior to action? How do we help this person if they're not acting on change yet? I think the first one is just casual follow-up and friendship building. Right? Stay in there with the person. Don't write them off because you start to build this friendship, but you see the amount of use in their life and they don't even care about it, so forget about it, right? I think you should try to maintain a decent friendship with the person, right? And build that exposure to fellowship. Again, they might start to question their use if they're seeing something a little bit more attractive than what they had or what they thought was possible, right? And so we can expose that. We bring them, if it's realistic, on retreats, home church events, I think there's conversation about, is this healthy? Is it going to be safe for the person and for us even sometimes to bring? We had an instance where it's not funny, but it's interesting. There was an individual who I was like, you know, Adam, and I'm like, we should probably not invite this person. I don't think it would be good, right? And at a certain point, you're like, they probably will use it, it would be damaging. And so we didn't. And then this guy brings this homemade moonshine on a retreat that we didn't know about and gets alcohol poisoning. You know, and it's like the ambulance comes, it's like, well, shoot, you know, I'm trying, you know. But I think we should consider, like, what's realistic, what's helpful, but try to move people in this direction. A short study on one of the topics above, right? Not necessarily as something you're going to do long term, but something that you're advertising. Like, God does offer something here that's better than this thing. Maybe you haven't thought of that yet. Take few risks. As far as, I don't know that the house or discipleship would be a wise thing at this point, right? Caitlin kind of spoke to how there is this pseudo-spirituality in addiction, and if somebody is still in full-blown addiction, right, I don't think they're going to be ready to jump on board with what God wants. So I think I'd be hesitant there. The most important thing here is maintaining boundaries. Okay, and this is, I think, a topic that will show the limits of our discussion this morning and what we can go through, but I do want to talk about boundaries. What does it look like to maintain boundaries when somebody's in their use? And boundaries are essentially your limitations, right? It's as far as you can go in helping the person. where it's as far as is healthy for you to go in helping the person. And having good boundaries requires knowing where you begin and where you end. If this is a topic that you'd like to study more and you'd like to develop a framework for, I think reading Henry Cloud's book, Boundaries, is good. There's a lot of information in there, but if you can find that one system he has, find the framework, it's really good. But where you begin and where you end, okay? And that's like, I can give, but I can't make you receive. I can offer counsel, but I cannot make you change. It's really important that we understand where we end for our own sanity. I think, you know, why is this so important? Because crossing boundaries leads to some counterproductive things, right? One is enabling, that you step in and you remove the natural consequences of specific decisions that would come about for the individual that might help them to move along the stages of change, right? And so that could be in many different areas. That could be in money, in shelter, in food, right? And we're going to talk about in a second why that doesn't mean you take those things away, but you don't want to kind of encourage their use by removing the consequences that would be coming about. Codependency, right? They get to a place where they're emotionally and psychologically dependent on you, right? They need you. They need you to be there in order to be sane, to be stable. Like, and addicts are boundaryless individuals, right? So they will seek those things sometimes indirectly or directly. How do I know I'm crossing boundaries, right? How can we know we're getting to that point, right? Because some people might have a higher emotional capacity than others in these kinds of things. I think one of the things, and this is kind of a helpful illustration, I was thinking about it, like, you know, when you become a helper for somebody who struggles with addiction, it's like you are getting on an elevator with that person that's going down, and you need to know when to step off, right? I need to know when I have to get off this thing because I don't want to go all the way down with this person, because that will be what happens. Guilt is a sign that you might be crossing boundaries, right? If their mistakes and their use is something you take on yourself, you blame yourself for, then there are some emotional boundaries being crossed, right? You are taking what they're responsible for on yourself. That's not healthy. Bitterness. When you get to a point where, I think it's really important we advertise ahead of time to people what our limitations are. That's one way we can enforce boundaries, right? To tell them where we begin and end. Right? That it's like, I am not going to continue to support this. I'm not going to be able to do this for you. I can't watch you do this to yourself. My wife and I, this one guy that was in our home church who was, who had gotten to a really good place, actually, his walk with God. And then I think trauma history kind of brought it back the other direction. It was like, got to a place where it was like, okay, he was going to work through some things. We helped move him in. Well, he got to a point where he just decided he did not want to work on things. It started getting worse. I noticed I was getting so pissed at this dude, like for just not being responsive and not utilizing the things that were put in front of him. And so I started getting bitter, and it just got to a point where I was like, listen, dude, I don't think this is helpful for you. And I just can't watch you do this. I can't watch you destroy yourself. Instability. When you start becoming emotionally, behaviorally unstable, you're probably getting to a point where you're crossing boundaries. And this is going to be terrible for your spiritual life. Your spiritual life will dry up and burn out. I think if you get to this point, let it continue. We had this guy coming out to our group, heroin addict, and he had been getting clean, getting better. He had a sister who, though, was very close, I mean, just great relationship, awesome relationship, and they just love each other, but his sister took a lot of his sobriety on herself. And he was doing well, and he got to a point where we're about to have him come into cell group and doing it. He relapsed, overdosed, and died. And it destroyed his sister. You know, there were conversations with her through a lot of the time they were both coming out. Like, you got to step back. You got to let other people get in there. But it was like anytime he needed anything, anytime he was like wanted to isolate, she would go and isolate with him. And it was just like you gotta say. And it just destroyed her. I mean, she just left. And I'm not sure what she's doing now, but I think she blames it all on God. And it's just emotional collapse. And so instability is a pretty good sign of this. Now, I want to talk about creating a bottom. So you might have heard this concept if you've ever been around somebody who goes to AA and NA or just addiction in general, hitting rock bottom, that the person has to hit bottom before they're ready to change. And I think that's a healthy or helpful conceptualization of like what happens when somebody reaches their limit and wants to change. I don't think it's so helpful for us as helpers, right? At least not as a guiding tool for what we should be doing. Because what can happen, I think, is we can try to help create that bottom. You know, like, well, no, like, if I kick them out now, they're going to see how bad it is and they're going to change, right? If I don't do this or I do this, then maybe the consequences are going to be more clear. I don't think that's helpful. And again, I think one reason why is because you don't know what's going to happen to that person. You know, you take that approach and that something awful happens to them, it's going to destroy you, right? And I don't think that's the goal. Let natural consequences bring that about. You don't have to artificially, you know, build them in there to the process. Instead, setting boundaries is going to be helpful because setting boundaries is going to allow someone to continue supporting without removing the natural consequences. It's like, I'm here for you, but I just can't watch you do this, right? I still have guys who haven't come out in a while, and I'll still get text messages, you know, like, dude, love you, just want to know this or that. You know, they're still using, some of them are in terrible places, but it's like, I still have contact with them. And that feels good because I think I'm walking that line, you know, I still have contact with them. Maybe I could still be helpful at some point. And something bad does happen. It's like, that's kind of one thing you took. What are some other considerations in enforcing boundaries? How to deal with defensiveness. What about this extreme defensiveness that comes from a lot of addicts, right? When they're trying to deny, because the defense mechanisms are refined and in full force with somebody who struggles with addiction. And so when you meet those, like, what do you do? Like, how do I set that boundary if they're constantly denying all these different things? And I just can't argue as fast or as well as this person. I've learned what's helpful in not expending too much energy on this and getting lost in it. Don't lose the forest for the trees. Just when you've noticed something is a problem, just appeal to the bigger picture, right? It's like, you know, dude, you're nodding off in the middle of our conversation. It's like, oh, well, I haven't slept in this long. You know, I'm exhausted. It's like, okay. It's like, I'm going to think through, how many times has that happened? What are the other signs, right? I'm going to say, well, here's the picture, okay? So I'm convinced you're using. Would somebody who's not using be having all of those things, right? And I just present the bigger picture and I establish my boundary on top of that because that's the best that I can do. And so I think we always appeal to the bigger picture. We get stuck in that. How close should you get to somebody in their addiction? Again, it's hard, it's tough, right? I think close enough to communicate ongoing support without crossing that line of enabling. Where is that line, right? Maybe I will. I'm not going to give you money. I might just give you this Kroger gift card with money on it to help you get some food. But if they keep coming back, it's like, okay, I'm not going to be the only one who feeds you, right? You need to find another source. It's like same. Just you got to find that line and continue to increase it when it's healthy. What if someone won't change? Right? There's a lot of people that we love. There's a lot of people that we care about who are destroying themselves. How do we deal with this? Like, and honestly, I just don't think that there's an easy way to do this. But one of the things I feel like I've learned with individuals I've seen die from overdose or just not leave and not come back is I think the perspective I've developed is like, I want to know I offered what I could if I end up at this person's funeral. If I'm standing at their casket, can I honestly say to myself, I communicated that I wanted to help. And I think I demonstrated that in these ways. And I think they knew that. That's the perspective that I want to have. I communicate I cared. Did I communicate I wanted to support? So how about early on in change? Again, these three bigger stages that we can make ministry decisions from. Early on in change, I think still casual follow-up and friendship building. Maintain friendship. Continue to build friendship. Go visit them in treatment centers, in jail. Our guys have done this a lot with many different people where some of our guys have gone and seen guys in treatment centers and done a short study with them, you know. Go visit them in jail. You that's radical, like, acceptance for them, man, that you're not judging them, but it's like, I care about you. You know, you're going through this tough process, and I want to be able to be here. We also have to anticipate extremes early on in change, right, because a lot of times there's withdrawal in different ways. And it's just, think, okay, in the maturity process, when do you grow? When do you grow the most in maturing? Well, it's going through difficult times and learning how to responsibly deal with that, right? These people have used through all those times, right? So the use is gone. They don't know how to deal with difficulty. So they're just screaming every emotion they have. They're reacting to everything, right? Emotions are out of whack. I remember when I was in treatment the last time when I got clean, I was sitting watching TV. I was by myself, thank God. And there was some commercial, I don't know what it was for, some a zoo or some nature thing, and there was a panda on TV, and I just start crying. I'm just crying at this panda. And I'm like, I don't care about pandas, you know? Like, what the hell is this? I don't know what this is. And but that was just a small picture of the things that would ultimately come in a lot of different areas, because I didn't know how to navigate things emotionally or even make sense of that kind of stuff. And that's what you'll see with a lot of people. And we've had people, that stage is a change thing. You'll see people get stuck there. You'll see them regress. You'll see them come back. We've had a lot of the people who are addicts who have actually sold out to following God are individuals I've seen leave and come back. Individuals have come out to sell. They're doing well. They're passionate. They don't want to give up this thing. They leave, right? One guy, this is incredible, and I don't want to take up all the time, but this was really blew my mind. But this dude went full back to use, worse than he was before, shooting dope, living homeless, on the streets, you know, whatever else. He describes his testimony. It's like one day he was going to pawn something off. He was going to sell something, I think, that he'd taken from his parents. And he's driving there, and he just thinks to himself, it just hits him, like, I don't have to do this. I know that where there's a place where people love me, they accept me, and where they're clean, and I can get help there. And it's just like, and he just took off from there, you know? And shortly after that, a friend of his died, and another one went to jail for something they did together. So that's just kind of a cool story, and there are a lot of these cool stories. But you want to build the strong individual relationships. When they're trust, we've had times where we have groups of people coming out from addiction treatment centers, and what you'll notice is they want to travel in packs. They want to stick together. And maybe they'll poke their head out, but they're going to go right back in because they love connecting over the dysfunction and the damage of the past and the things that were gross and how low they fell. And they're really intimidated by normalcy, by normal people, right? Like this healthy person is probably going to be judging. And so you got to get in there one-on-one and you got to build trust. Consider taking risks at this place. We've taken some risks that have paid off and some that haven't paid off. Maybe discipleship, maybe moving them into the house, right? This is dependent on traction and spiritual growth. And maybe make it conditional on counseling and addiction meetings. A lot of our guys go see the counselors at Xenos and get a lot of benefits from it. And it's very stabilizing. And so I think that's a pretty good condition, even as just something that's supplemental, trying to help them see, like, I think you could really benefit from this. So we as a church should be using our resources, especially like the counseling we have here, because it's good. It's really helpful. Long-term. I think long-term, right, this is where hopefully if they're still coming around, it's long-term, they've kind of started to move into follow-up and discipleship, more involved follow-up and discipleship. And, you know, some of the things I think that are really important to cover with this person long-term is teaching to distinguish truth from emotion, right? You've got to learn to identify what is true. position versus condition is stuff we talk a lot about. Disputing thoughts with scripture, I will continue to bring this up. I will go back to this constantly with my guys. 1 John 3:1 is one that I really hit on, right? See how great a love, oh, not, sorry, that's 1 John 3:1. I mean 1 John 3:20, where it's, and we will reassure our hearts in the presence of the Lord in whatever our heart condemns us. For God is greater than our heart and knows all things. Right? You just appeal from that. Like, see, God is the authority. Your heart is not, right? Considerations in the ministry house. It's not a sober house, right? You've got to walk this line between if it offends my brother that I eat meat, I won't eat meat, and not becoming a full-blown sober house. We've had to kind of watch that balance over time, and at different times it swung to different extremes, but you got to find that, right? And maybe that is don't keep alcohol in the fridge, don't hang out at bars or companies, hang out with this other dude, make sure he's comfortable when people are doing that. What about relapse? I think this is the last thing that we're going to cover here. This gets tough when somebody's doing really well and then they seem to kind of go downhill. And we've had a couple cases of this that have been pretty rough. I think one of the things, and it's rough to navigate, right? Like, well, how do I treat this? Do I treat this as part of what it was? The drunkenness should be disciplinable. Like, well, you know, how do I approach this? How do I make decisions, healthy ministry decisions with this person? Well, I think one of the things you have to decide is, like, is this self-medicating or is it pleasure-seeking, right? We've had times where it's like anxiety stuff has come back up as new trauma stuff has come back out and guys, like, you know, start doing these little things and little instances and confess it real quickly and it's like, seems like self-medicating. I think there should be a little bit of mercy here. to what degree are they utilizing the resources they have? Because again, we are assessing the heart, right? The things that are in their control, right? What are they doing with that? Like, are they in their choice at least trying to utilize those resources they have, or are they neglecting them? Because if they're neglecting them, they're not trying, you know? To what degree are they trying to give out spiritually? That's part of the whole point of this. Has it just turned to kind of an inward, decline? Or is this person still attempting to move outward? At what point should we consider church discipline? Again, this is, I think, all these different factors go into that, right? Like, are they doing these things? If you're not sure, and again, in one case we weren't, that was, dude, we had move in to my house, and it's like, dude, if you want to get help, you can do that here, and hopefully it'll be a stable place to do that. And, you know, and that made it a little bit more clear, and this the dude just kind of left. So, I don't know. So we got to get creative with that. But anyways, so I'm going to hand it over to a dude who I've known for a long time, and I've known this dude since he, I think, was just right after his senior year in high school, and I've watched him come out of substance addiction, grow spiritually. And so he's going to come up and give his personal testimony.
Hello. My name is Max. I'm an alcoholic. Hello. I'm just kidding. I'm not an alcoholic. But if you hear someone say that, you're supposed to say, hi, Max. But that's only in the 12-step community. I'm not an alcoholic. I actually was. I was a heroin addict. Been sober about 8 years now, almost 8 years, 7.5 to 8 years. I want to, a little background before I go more extensively into my background. I didn't grow up a Christian. Since I've been sober, I've been involved in Hope Ministry the whole time. I got involved in Hope Ministry about a month after I got sober, and I've been leading there for about 6 years, and then I have... I've been working professionally in the addiction counseling field for about 5 years, 5 or 6 years. My background is I started using substances at the age of 14, 13 or 14. And when I used to consider why did I start using substances, or if someone asked me that, I would every time, and I was convinced of this for a long time after I got sober, I would tell you I was a 14-year-old kid in the suburbs with nothing to do and no accountability, and so I started using, and it felt good, and so I started doing it more, and gradually over time I developed a serious addiction to substances. That is very far from the extent of why I started using substances. As I've been sober longer and considered it more, if you think about the different things that Kate was talking about of why do people become addicts, I could check all of those boxes. I had the genetic component. My dad, my grandpa, my grandma were all serious alcoholics. And then I had the trauma or the adverse childhood experience from when I was a kid. Up until I was in eighth grade, I lived a perfect, comfortable life. But the whole time, my dad was drinking one to two handles of vodka every day. So he was an absent father. We had no idea, though. He was a closet alcoholic. And that all came out when I was in eighth grade. And he left. He left my mom, and then my mom, and he left the family. And then my mom was extremely depressed. And so really, I had abandonment. I had this immediate, intense, relatively traumatic experience where I find out, like, this is what my dad's been doing this whole time, and he's been driving our family in a really bad direction, and now he's gone. And then with what was going on with my mom, I was an eighth grade. I was 12 years old, and I had this happen. I had no one there to help me through this or to teach me about why this is happening. And I didn't grow up in the church. I didn't grow up as a Christian. And so I had no foundation to go back to for why these things happen. And so I developed all these different beliefs. And the primary one for me, though, was that this sucks. This is this this is really uncomfortable. These emotions are really difficult. I don't want to feel this way. And so I ignored it. The 2 weeks after that happened were really intense and really sad. And then I moved forward and acted like it didn't happen. There's a lot of pain though that I was neglecting. And so then it's no surprise that within a year of that happening, I was abusing substances and started smoking weed. After about 6 months, I was using substances daily. After about a year, when I was probably 15, I was using opiates just about daily. And my use gradually progressed to the point where, you know, I was sticking needles in my arm and using heroin daily. But the use, I didn't see that progression for a while. I didn't realize that's the path that I was headed down until I was kind of already there. But I had this pain, I had these difficulties, and I had no sense of purpose. I had this emptiness, and so the use filled that. It gave me something to live for, and it gave me it made me feel good, and it took away the pain. But the first time I went to treatment, I was 16 years old. And between ages 16 and 19, I think I got sober four times before the last time I got sober when I was 19. And every time I got sober, after about 3 months, I would relapse, because sometimes I went to AA and NA meetings and I did it that way. Sometimes I realized I have a serious problem. I need help. I need to stop doing this. I went through counseling or treatment, but I never dealt with the issues, and I never replaced, like what Danny was talking about. All I did was resist. And so then, after the initial emotional high and excitement about being sober wore off, I was totally depressed and alone, and I had all of this emotional pain, which I don't like to deal with, and so I would start using again. Eventually, it got to the point, you know, where I'm using heroin. I've got nobody left. I've ruined most of my good relationships, and I had lots of bad consequences. And I came here. I hit a point of brokenness, and I reached out to God, and I ended up here. And I started a relationship with Christ, and I got sober, and I've been sober since then. I want to talk a little bit about what other people did to help me get to that point and move through my addiction after I came to Christ. One of the most important things was how people related to me before I finally got sober. I got connected with Danny and some other guys in my home church when I was, the second time I got sober, when I was 17 years old. And I started staying the night at the ministry house, and we'd talk about apologetics, they'd answer my questions, would not go to a Bible study. I was very stubborn and proud. I liked the idea of God, but I didn't need Jesus. That was for them, not for me. And so, you know, I'd be there for 3 months and building relationships. I relapsed because I was trying to do it on my own. But through those times when I relapsed and then when I was using, they would continue to call me. They would continue to check in with me and see how I'm doing. They never ostracized me or told me, you can't come around here, you can't talk to us because you're using. I never had the thought that something like that would happen, because they had a real welcomeness and love and compassion towards me that was shown through their actions. And so when I got to the point where my use had progressed and I wanted change, I wanted to help, I never thought, I can't go back there. Those guys aren't going to accept me after how many times I've left and not listened to them. I knew, like, I can call these guys. These guys are going to be there, and they're going to be there to help me. And all of those conversations that I had with them and everything, that stuck through until I finally got sober. It can be easy when you're working with people who have substance use issues if they relapse to think, we just wasted so much time. But when I came back after 2 years, that was the thing that I remembered is, man, these guys, they have invested so much time in me and so much love, and he said this then, and here they are, they're still loving me. And so even if you don't see immediate fruit or results or impact, it carries over. I mean, 1 Corinthians 15:58, God says, always give yourselves fully to the work of the Lord, because you know that your labor in the Lord is not in vain. Even if you don't see the results, you know, when you're choosing to love someone who's created in the image of God, it's not going to be in vain. And so that was extremely helpful to me. And I think one of the other things that was so helpful was people who weren't addicts that were loving me. Sometimes we think like, well, I haven't struggled with that thing, so I can't help them. He was talking about that. The person who's discipled me and been one of the most influential people wasn't an addict, right? You don't have to be able to love a broken person through their sin and help them grow. You don't have to have the same sin, right? That's just unbiblical. What's really important in dealing with that is empathy, right? Looking to understand. I've never been through this myself. Can you help me understand, like, What is this like? And lastly, I think in principle, one of the biggest things we talk all the time about our new identity in Christ and living out of your new identity rather than your old identity and viewing yourself the way that God views you. We don't talk as much about viewing other people the same way, right? When you have a heroin addict who's got all of these issues going on, sometimes it's hard to look at them as not a heroin addict, but as a child of God, as a new creation, you know, someone who's loved and valued and accepted. But these guys that God put in my life, that's how they viewed me, and that played out in practice. So I had a very bad picture of my identity. I'd done messed up things, I had issues, I had deep views of myself that were wrong. But these people were approaching me not as, you're worthless, you have these issues, you have no hope for change. The way that they related me communicated, you have value, there is hope, you can have confidence that God wants these things. So if you have someone struggling with these things, like looking for ways to instill hope and confidence, this is who God has made you to be. This is what God wants to do, and treating them like they're a brother and sister in Christ rather than this junkie from the street or something like that.
I just want to speak to, okay, the Moose brought up the ministries. His nickname's Moose. So he brought up the different ministries we have. I think if you're in a relationship where you're supported, trying to keep boundaries, you should definitely try to seek out a support group for yourself, like Promise would be a great one. I also think the Hope Ministry, I have personally watched how many guys go, at least four or five dudes come out through that ministry who are leading in a different ministry now in Xenos. So it's not a ministry where somebody just goes, again, not fix what's broken. They don't just go for support. I've watched dudes develop into leaders as they've gone out to that, from getting receiving help to giving help to teaching to... And so, and I really want to just kind of put that out there, because I think sometimes the bar is pretty high for where somebody can really go, the impact they can have. So I just, again, want to plug our ministries. I think they're doing an awesome job. Cool. Why don't I pray for us? Yeah, God, well, we just, we recognize your compassion for the broken and the lost and the hurting, God. We know that... This world is not in the state that you intended it to be when you designed it. We are not in the state you intended us to be when you designed humanity. And we know that you are the ultimate source of healing. But we know that there is wisdom that we need in coming alongside somebody who needs healing. And we pray for that wisdom. We just ask that you would continue to teach us, Lord. Teach us first, and I think most importantly, how to effectively love people who are hard to love. how can we maintain patience and these different things that it takes to love these people, and help us to see the broken and the hurting through your eyes, God. We just really want a growing desire to help those. And so we just pray for that, Lord, and I pray that this information could be used to glorify you and grow your kingdom. Amen.